Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, March 26th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, bringing interventional radiology, immunotherapy, and robot-assisted surgery to cancer care for the greater Saratoga community. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining this afternoon, and we're lucky to have him for Medical Monday, is Dr. Mark Pettis of Berkshire Health Systems. He's here to answer your questions about general health and medical education. We always get a lot of calls on this program. Mark Pettis knows more than anybody I know about this stuff, so get in early, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Pettis, your calls, all much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop. When? Well, right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WOMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week on Medical Monday is an old friend of mine and a guy I very much admire, Dr. Mark Pettis of Berkshire Health Systems. Dr. Pettis is a triple board certified internist, nephrologist, and integrative medicine physician practicing for more than 25 years. He's director of medical education, wellness, and population health at BHS. Dr. Pettis also serves as the associate dean of medical education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Healthcare, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. He serves on the teaching faculty at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine based in Washington, D.C., and the Meditation Institute in Avril Park, New York. Hey, Mark Pettis, welcome back to Medical Monday. It's always great when you're here.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be with you.
The number to call, everybody, and people are getting it already, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Mark, to what degree is there a mind-body connection?
The mind-body connection is enormous, Alan, and while there's always been a longstanding appreciation for how our thoughts are powerful in the way that they influence our biology and ultimately our health. Research, I'd say over the last 10 years or so, with MRI imaging and EEG imaging, is suggesting profound connections. And so how we look at our lives will have a lot to say about the reality we create in our lives.
Let me ask you a question. How important is sleep?
Sleep is one of the, I'd say, the top four. You know, we talk about exercise, we talk about good nutrition, we talk about managing stress. Sleep would be that fourth corner. And virtually every chronic complex disease, Alan, from heart disease to Alzheimer's to cancer to diabetes to weight issues, are all strongly related to disruptive sleep patterns. So it's a big issue.
As the king of disruptive sleep, let me ask you, me, not you, how do you get over that?
So it's a challenge, particularly working as you do, Alan. You're up early, you're in early. So we know that when you look at night shift workers in general, and a lot of this work comes from clinical hospital settings, but the same can be said for firefighters and police officers that work night or rotating shifts. Strong connections in terms of inflammation, sort of the stress response, what we call fight flight. So working as you do just creates a difficult challenge to begin with. But I think what's most important is having a consistent pattern of going to bed and waking up. Sleep hygiene is so important. So we now know that our brains are sensitive to even the smallest amounts of light, what we call blue light. So not having light coming into our bedrooms at night is huge. Keeping it dark, keeping our bedrooms cool. An ideal temperature is probably 64 to 65 degrees for sleeping at night. And we know that a lot of our modern technology, whether it's a smartphone, whether it's a laptop or a computer, will tend to give off more blue light. And blue light will inhibit melatonin, which is key for signaling the onset of sleep. So modern life and the lighting in modern life makes it even difficult for us to sort of maintain those biorhythms.
So would you say it's wrong? Because Joe Donahue sends us, I go to bed at 7, but I get up at 2.
Mm-hmm.
So our Joe Donahue sends us the topics we're going to discuss the next day and the reference the articles. So after I sleep for my first hour and a half, 2 hours, I get up and I read the what he sent me. That's wrong, right?
Well, I think conventional wisdom has been getting consecutive hours of sleep is probably ideal. But when you look at ancestral patterns, it was very common for our ancient ancestors to get up at some point after a few hours of falling asleep and then to return to bed. So I think what's most important is what gets deposited into the sleep bank over the course of the night, even if you are waking up.
Oh, interesting.
And the quality of that sleep. So, you know, you can be in bed for 6 hours, and if you're not getting into those deeper levels of REM sleep, you may not feel as restored, and there may be some risk as compared to if you are.
Well, we're getting calls. Let's go to the our usual first caller, Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
How many medical schools are currently in the U.S., and has the duration of the flu in individuals been exceptionally long this year?
The first question, Jim, and this may not be 100% accurate because there have been a few more additions in the U.S. To the medical school network over the last year or so, but we have approximately 128 medical schools in the United States.
That's all, huh?
And many medical schools are increasing their enrollment in an effort to deal with workforce shortages, particularly in primary care, which is a huge issue in the Berkshires in this region and around many parts of the U.S. With respect to the flu, definitely a more harsh season this year. Most of the data that I see is regional data, and clearly we're over the hump here. And a lot of this is based on people presenting to urgent care and emergency departments in a particular region who are actually tested for influenza. This is usually a swab of the nose or coughing. We've seen a dramatic drop in confirmation of influenza. So we're over the hump for sure on the tail end, but this was a tough season.
Thank you, Jim. That's very interesting. As the head guy for sort of medical education, everything in your area, you're really top draw. How do we know? I do know that the economics of healthcare is so important, right? It used to be a golden thread if you were going to be a doctor.
Mm.
But in fact, doctors are making not that much money these days, especially general practitioners. I've often wondered why anybody would become a general practitioner when the specialists are making all the money.
And that indeed has been the trend over the last generation, Alan. The traditional coveted jack of all trades, general practitioner, primary care provider, pediatrician, they don't make as much as many other specialists.
They can be making $150,000, $200,000 a year, not a lot of money for them.
Exactly. And you're coming out of school now with an average of $150,000 plus of debt. So many students will choose more lucrative fields in an effort to try to unload that debt more quickly and to generate more income in their professional lives. The disparities are a real problem, and unfortunately, I think they have contributed to many of the disparities and shortages that we have in primary care.
Go find a dermatologist.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to David and Troy. David and Troy, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Doctor, it sounds like you have a wide range of experience, and this is an honest question. It is not meant to be political. A few weeks ago, I read a fascinating and frightening article by a radiologist named Heather Scher, S-H-E-R, who treated the victims at the school shooting in Parkland. And she had wide experience, she said, of diagnosing and treating thousands of handgun injuries to the body everywhere. And she said this was the only second time that she witnessed something that she describes as an organ that looked like an overripe melon smashed by a sledgehammer with extensive bleeding. How could a gunshot wound have caused this much damage? Do you think, do you believe, subscribe to the idea that with all the talk about gun control, et cetera, that there is a health problem in this country regarding these kinds of trauma, and that there's certainly a difference between a high-powered semi-automatic weapon wound and a single shot handgun wound?
Okay, let's take that as the question. Mark.
Yeah, David. So that's a profound question. And while I'm not a trauma physician, I've seen a lot of trauma. It's sort of a profound image that you present through that article. We're on uncharted waters, I think, in terms of the nature of modern trauma that we see, from explosive devices, from these military-grade weapons.
Indeed.
And then there's this whole complicated layer of the general pressure that many people are under and the extent to which they decompensate. People talk a lot about our mental health issues, and I would suggest even the treatment for many mental health issues we know can create volatile behaviors. It's such a complicated issue. It's a part of a whole. But I think what you describe is a new to nature phenomenon no generation before us has experienced, and it's a sad commentary.
David, thank you.
Well, I just want to finish by saying I admire particularly those physicians and nurses who work in emergency rooms and have to deal with all kinds of horrible injuries all the time, from car accidents, gunshot wounds, et cetera. I admire you, and I think we all thank you and acknowledge you for your work.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Laura Brown of UMA Schenectady, formerly no-nonsense therapeutic massage, providing stress and chronic or acute pain therapy using an array of massage modalities. ume.amtamembers.com. Nathan LaTower Hospital and Nursing Home welcoming David Eisenberg, MD, to their pediatric staff at Primary Specialty Care Center in Perth. 518-883-8624 for an appointment. New York Oncology Hematology reminding WAMC listeners that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. NewYorkOncology.com for information about warning signs and screenings. The Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butterscratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. And Berkshire Country Day, an independent pre-K to 9 school, comprehensive curriculum, and an emphasis on community. Open house April 5th, intentional, independent, inspired, BerkshireCountryDay.org.
We are back, and we're very lucky to have Dr. Mark Pettis with us of the Berkshire Health Systems. Let's go to Mark in Salem. All right, Mark in Salem, you're on.
Hello, Alan. I have a comment for you and a question for the doctor. The comment to you is that you had a previous program with the Mohawk Orthopedics, with Dr. Popper, and I bit the bullet. I went out, and I was cured.
You were cured, I tell you. Cured. That's wonderful.
They gave me all this oxycodone to take. I didn't have to take a single painkiller.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I was really amazed. The question I have is back to the sleep issue. I've always been a person who's had difficulty falling asleep. Once I fall asleep, I tend to stay asleep all night. And I have a routine. I'm very good about it. I usually listen to your 11 to 12 program from Canada as it happens. And then I work on a model or something. But about an hour before I go to bed lately, I have taken one acetaminophen PM, and I wondered what the doctor thought about doing that over a long period of time. I find that it causes me to be little drowsy enough that I drop off pretty rapidly.
Now, is that Tylenol to the rest of us common people?
Yes.
No, it's acetaminophen.
Isn't that Tylenol?
Acetaminophen is what's in Tylenol.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
And I'm not sure, Mark, what the PM, often PM when I hear that, they put in an additional ingredient like an antihistamine, like
I think that's what's in this.
A Benadryl-like ingredient. So, you know, the simple answer, Mark, is that, you know, in a low dose of acetaminophen and an antihistamine, there's probably very little downside if it's something that you find helps you. I think where I would put maybe a footnote is that acetaminophen in particular, taken regularly. Now, you're talking about a very low dose here.
Just one, yeah.
But acetaminophen taken regularly can, for some people, affect the liver's ability to detoxify. One of the liver's many roles is to eliminate toxins, and occasionally acetaminophen, even in low dose taken regularly, can interfere with that. I'd say the risk there is extraordinarily low, and if this is what you were taking to help you, probably fine. I would focus on things that Alan and I were just addressing in terms of sleep hygiene, lighting, maybe a little melatonin, sometimes some simple mind-body relaxation techniques can help as well.
I work on a model, usually a model boat or a model train, and I listen to the Canadian broadcasting to kind of, you know, get me in out of the busyness of the day kind of mode, and then I take that while I start the project, and by the time I'm done an hour later when the program goes off, my eyes are droopy and I get in bed and I fall asleep. If I don't take it, I find myself, you know, running through the day again and just not being able to shut down.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, now let's go to Robert in Millertown, remembering that we're getting a lot of calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we have to keep our remarks short. Okay, here we go. Over to Robert in Millertown. Okay, go ahead, Robert.
Okay, very good, Professor. Proverbs 14:30 says, "A calm heart gives life to the body, but jealousy is rottenness to the bones." That was mentioned over 2,000 years ago. And
nothing's changed.
Also, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed. Our body hasn't changed, and you know, that's good medical advice.
Okay, stop right there. We're going to have Mark comment. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, great ancient wisdom, Robert, and the best wisdom out there is the wisdom of the ancient traditions, including what you just quoted. A calm heart is good for everything, and that calmness leads to compassion and empathy, and the world would be a better place if people were able to practice that.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, now we're going to go to Tim in Pittsfield. I want to give that number. All of a sudden, we can get a couple more calls in. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Tim in Pittsfield, you're on.
Thank you, Doctor. I'll keep my remarks as brief as possible.
Good. Very important.
I'm a recovering opioid addict, and I'm currently enrolled in the Suboxone program. I'm also a very highly successful professional, and I'm calling because I want to, number one, make clear that I've found that this crisis cuts across socioeconomic strata. It's not confined to the poor, the destitute, et cetera. It's a horrible, horrible crisis and disease. I have found remarkable results through use of the Suboxone program, and I'm wondering if you yourself could speak to any results that you've had with that, and if you can suggest other alternatives for people who are in recovery in addition to Suboxone to help in their recovery. Thank you, Tim,
you've come to the right place. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. First of all, I appreciate your comments with respect to how pervasive this challenge is, opiate addiction, and it observes no socioeconomic category, by all means. Suboxone really is part of this general category of medication-assisted therapies buprenorphine, another a medication that's used, Vivitrol, which is a type of Narcan. Many of these medication-assisted therapies work by blocking the opioid receptor in the brain, which has two effects. One is that it will reduce withdrawal symptoms and craving, associated with that. So I do think medication-assisted therapies are an enormously important dimension of treatment. There's certainly a lot of interest, and this is usually in the setting of integrative pain management, where one may have been taken an opiate in the first place for some type of chronic pain. And I think we're seeing a growing number of models that, in addition to medication-associated treatment, would employ things like acupuncture, other mind-body skills that might include meditation, guided imagery, group models. Bringing people together in and of itself is very therapeutic, as you share your story and people begin to share the journey together. And then, I think there's a lot of interest in the nutrition field. There are many foods that are anti-inflammatory. When one sort of gets away from processed foods like sugar, flour, and introduces more plant-based foods, it's clear that chronic pain can significantly shift in addition to medication-assisted therapy, some of these other mind-body techniques as well. So this is an epidemic, and I think we're going to be seeing more and more programs that use what you describe in the context of other treatments so that you don't need to be on Suboxone for your entire life.
Thank you, Tim. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Chances of getting in now are excellent. Let's go to John in Liberty. John in Liberty, you're on.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I wanted to ask you all, including yourself, Dr. Chardoff, if you've heard of Anthony William. He's called the medical medium, and he's got three New York Times best-selling books, one about chronic illness. Could I just ask you if either of you have heard of this gentleman?
Well, I can tell you I haven't. But that's okay.
Yeah, I've heard the name, John, but I'm not familiar with his writing.
Okay, well, I recently read two of his books. One is about the thyroid, and the other is about chronic illness. And, I just like to mention his name and the name of his books because it has completely revolutionized my outlook toward my chronic illness, which has been Lyme disease. And he talks about Epstein-Barr virus and how it's morphed into various strains, and that basically all illness that we face, from cancer on down the list, is caused by the Epstein-Barr virus and the viral load in our bodies. So anyone suffering from chronic illness, I'd like to recommend this author. He's called The Medical Medium.
Yeah, so John, thank you for that, and I will look up the references you note. I do think we have a great deal of uncertainty in our understanding of chronic infection, whether it be Epstein-Barr or Lyme or other infections that tend to remit and relapse. And there's no question many people with chronic illness, otherwise not well understood, is likely to have some connection. There are many other things, mold in the environment, other chronic inflammatory triggers. And so I think any lens that can bring someone to lifestyle-related measures is always worth looking at.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's go to J.D. in Springfield. J.D., you're on.
Hi, thank you. Really good show. I had to discover what to do about my sleep thing several years ago, and it looks like I kind of discovered your method because I had to pay attention. I'm actually a night person, so I got a whole lot of stuff accomplished, but the crash that I suffered from because living in a day world and doing the day and night thing. So the first thing I did was pay attention to my body rhythms, and then I followed all the directions, like paying attention to when I needed to get up in the morning and then work backwards so that I would have at least 8 hours flat time, I have to call it. because I sleep on the floor and I sleep much better. So anyhow, just wanted to say that, you know, thank you for spreading the word. And I did want to say that, you know, I use pretty much the same thing. I don't eat a lot of refined stuff. And I'm saying thank you for putting this on the air because, you know, it was a long journey for me to discover. And if anyone else can avoid the crash of, you know, complete physical exhaustion, I would suggest that. So thanks.
Okay,
and thanks
for
the show.
Thank you, J.D.
Thanks, J.D.
Okay, and let's go to line number one and Janet in East Nassau. Janet, you're on.
Hi. I've just been referred to by a sleep doctor to a behavioral psychologist who specializes in working with people who have long-term insomnia. And I'm happy to do this. I had never heard of it before. I did agree with the doctor I saw that I did not want to go on sleeping medicine. I basically take ZQL now. So I wonder what you know about that kind of a practice.
Well, I think more sleep centers are developing integrative models, Janet, that include not just the traditional things that a sleep specialist might measure, you know, sleep apnea and oxygen levels and brainwave activity, but sleep is complex, and there are often emotional overlays that might relate to anxiety,
exactly.
Sometimes depression. Often as people get older and start to have cognitive decline, we might call that early Alzheimer's, disrupted sleep is often one of the initial manifestations of that. So I think the best way to look at sleep is to look at the traditional things, to look at cognitive behavioral therapies as you are embarking on. They can be very revealing, and they can help with other aspects of life and quality of life. I think nutrition, particularly timing of eating, not eating too close to bedtime, trying to synchronize one's mealtime with circadian rhythms, very, very important. And then the last thing I would say would be light quality. Again, it's good to get outdoors, to get as much natural light, and to try to synchronize your biologic rhythms with the sunrise and sunset cycling. That's a powerful and evolutionary biologic process that in modern life we struggle to maintain some synchronization with.
Just like the cavemen. Thank you very much, Janet. Okay, and now we're off to Martin in Cahoes. Martin in Cahoes.
Hello.
Go.
Hello.
Hi, Martin.
I'd like to make a comment rather than have a question. Is that okay? It's about
well, it depends on how long the comment goes. Go ahead.
I'll try to make it quick. I lost my son this past summer opiates, and I just want you to understand that they don't always die from the opiates themselves. Things happen during their years and years of opiate use. They get infections. I was a nurse my whole life, and I'm here to tell you a lot of people in the healthcare system do not really treat people with histories of opiate abuse the same as they would treat a good, upstanding family member that walks in. We went to the ER countless times with infections for my son. And as a nurse, I know he did not get the proper treatment. And we tried. We tried so hard. Finally, the infection reached his backbone. He got laid up. He was unable to walk. Next thing we know, the infection reached his heart and he passed away. He was clean of drugs for over a year and was going from church to church, trying to be a soldier against drugs. Yet here we have the system working against the very best people in that situation.
Okay, so Martin, let's get a comment from Dr. Pettis.
Yeah, Martin, thank you for sharing that, and I'm sorry about your loss. Your point is so important in that opiates are often in the context of many other aspects of life and living that can include infections like you describe, endocarditis, infections of the heart valves, and other medical-related issues. And unfortunately, I think there are still stigmas involved with anyone dealing with those histories that might affect the lens through which a caregiver is seeing In this example, your son. That's a sad reality, something we all continue to try to work on as professionals. People like yourself that have the courage to share those stories so that others can learn from what you've experienced is the best way to open others' eyes. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Martin. Okay, so let's go to Sue in Saratoga. Sue in Saratoga, you're on. Sue.
Hi, good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you for this wonderful show. I am a 64-year-old woman who suffered from shingles 7 months ago, and I'm still kind of dealing with the disability of how horrible it was. And there's a new Shingrix vaccine out. I'd like to get it. However, it's so new. Are you seeing any major side effects with this new vaccine?
I can't say that. Yeah, great question. I can't say that I've had a lot of personal experience with the Shingrix, the newer vaccine. The track record in general for the predecessor was generally good, and I think the greatest value, when there was value, is in reducing the neuralgia that one might be at risk for after getting shingles. So I think it's worth doing. I think the risks are minimal relative to the benefits, and you know, worth looking into for sure.
Okay, thank you for that. We're going to take a very, very short break, and then we'll have a lot of time to come back. We got Brian on the phone, Jim, we got letters. Let's get going.
Support comes from Act Smart New York, Saratoga Springs, offering individualized outpatient counseling and Suboxone treatment for opioid use disorder and medical treatment for alcohol problems. ActSmartNewYork.com. Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture. Specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarriers and fabricators used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Chester Common Table, Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts. Locally sourced comfort food, beers, wine, and cocktails. Live music every Friday. ChesterCommonTable.com. And Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts. An independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years. The-Gazebo.com.
Thank you, Zachary. We're back with Dr. Mark Pettis. Boy, triple board certified internist, nephrologist, and integrative medicine physician, and running a good deal of what the Berkshire Medical Center does. And Mark, it's always incredible that you find the time to get away and spend some time with us. We're very, very
always great being with you, Alan. Thank you.
Very appreciative. Okay, so now we'll go to Jim in Elizaville. Okay, Jim in Elizaville.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just didn't know if anybody had commented on the difference between what the opioid scene was like in the past and what it is now. And the way I look at it is, it used to be considered a problem for minorities and the poor, and now that it has affected more of the white population of the United States, it's become a national crisis. Has anybody made any comments about that or drawn any conclusions?
Yeah, that's a really great observation you make there, Jim. Some of the best work in this area are actually two economists from Princeton, Case and Deaton, and they have looked at the epidemiology of heroin and opiate abuse over the last generation, and there's been a dramatic shift involving the poor white demographic, and some of the highest mortality rates are in that demographic, sort of that Rust Belt demographic. And if you look at mortality rates in general in the United States, they've actually upticked. It's one of the first times in the last generation where mortality rates have gone up. And when you look at the causes of that, which Case and Deaton drill into in a very sophisticated way.
When you say go up, it means more people dying.
More people are dying. Yeah. It is that poor white demographic. And it's heroin overdose. It's cirrhosis of the liver from alcohol. And it's suicides.
Right.
And they all overlap in their epidemiology. So it's a huge problem, and it is shifting.
Has anybody made the connection between the fact that, well, I think that people are making less money now in general in the United States than they did in the past?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that lower socioeconomic status or shifts in a downward direction of socioeconomic status, what we would call the social determinants of health, impact every chronic complex disease risk, including substance use, including suicide, including depression. So, you know, I think there are clear links between the economy and how well people are doing in the economy and the health of our society. And they coexist in a very tightly correlated way. So as the economy goes, generally health upticks with that.
One more reason to raise the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call, and have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. I mean excellent. Let's go to Brian in Shelburne Falls. All right, Brian, you're on.
Hello, Alan, and thank you for all that you do and for mentioning the doctor's many degrees and experiences, because we're talking to someone that's both medical and alternative.
You bet.
And that's where my question is going to. And that is, doctor, it seems like you're saying, and I think you might agree, that the root cause now of inflammation of all of the major illnesses, even the fibromat, that is causing many of the problems that we have is anxiety and unrealistic fear and our drip lining of adrenaline. And that affects our immune response, aging, pain in the body, and our physical, mental, and emotional state. I'm wondering if you think that working an incompatible behavior, a program that teaches us to be grateful from the moment we wake up and being in a pause and reflect state of mind and choosing compassion consciously for all beings that we meet with appropriate boundaries and being compassionate to ourselves would be a natural way to run anti-inflammatory hormones and offset and actually eliminate some of that anxiety because it's an incompatible behavior.
Okay, let's get an answer. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, so I couldn't have put that better, Brian. There's no question that compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and its many expressions significantly lowers the immune response and predicts a much longer life and healthier life. And when you add that to eating healthier foods and moving judiciously and being mindful of circadian rhythms, as we've been talking about, and being connecting and loving, caring relationships, that's the holy grail for health. And there are many places on the planet where those types of life exist. We call those the blue zones. And when you look at the blue zones like Okinawa, Japan, and Icarus, a Greek island, the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, people live longer than any other place on the planet. They have a very, very low disease risk and very, very high quality of life.
Thank you for that. That's a great call. Okay, so let's now go to Sharon in Selkirk. All right, Sharon, you're on.
Hi there.
Hey.
I have a question. It's a follow-up question about the woman who had the shingles, and she was talking about getting a vaccine. Isn't shingles related to chickenpox? And would it be true then that since she's had the disease already, that she wouldn't necessarily need a follow-up vaccine?
Yeah, so you raise a very good point, Sharon. Shingles is the chickenpox virus. It's called varicella zoster. Traditional thinking was that once you got shingles, you know, chances are you'd never get it again in your lifetime. I think the evidence would suggest that you can get it more than once. While that may be more the exception than the rule, if somebody's had shingles, particularly in a part of the body that might have been a bit more problematic, the face involving the eye, for example, while I think the benefit of vaccination after shingles might be relatively low. I don't think it's zero. And I would just try to have that risk benefit assessment with someone.
I'm sorry, Mark. How long does it last, shingles?
So the rash itself from shingles typically will last 10 to 14 days, Alan. It's what happens after the rash resolves, which for a smaller percentage of people who get it will get this pain, this neuralgia, the nerve root where the virus has infected remains activated and inflamed. So that's the main indication for the vaccine to reduce the likelihood of that happening. But with shingles, the risk of subsequent shingles is much lower, for sure.
Thank you, Sharon. All right, now we'll go to, let's see here, Tom in Saratoga. Tom in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi there. Now that I'm getting older, you talked about sleep apnea. I've only slept 4 hours a night for the last 50 years. And sometimes I go days without sleeping. But it never bothers me. I'm never tired. And I work a very vigorous new job. So, I mean, should I, now that I'm over 60, I mean, I keep hearing that it hurts your heart and everything else. I mean, is that true for everybody or?
Well, certainly there are some who are going to be more resilient than others, Tom, and people will be more tolerant of sleep debt, not getting enough sleep, as you seem to be. But I would say as a general rule, particularly as we get older, chronic sleep deprivation, and for most people, 4 hours a night is not going to be sufficient. There are strong, strong connections with chronic complex disease, including Alzheimer's, including other neurologic issues, MS, Parkinson's, et cetera, heart disease. So, you know, there's one issue of subjectively how it affects you. Then there's another issue of how your immune system, your circadian cortisol, you know, rise and fall, how all those things, failure to sort of normalize those things in time could be problematic.
So how do you go to find out about your circadian rhythm?
Yeah, so a sleep specialist, most of them traditionally trained, are going to look at for things like sleep apnea.
Sure.
Which is a mechanical issue, as I think most of your listeners know, Alan, where it gets a little more tricky. And this is where I think the one has to get outside that traditional box is understanding that there are many aspects of lifestyle that affect sleep quality. Timing of our meals each day is a big one. Padma Sharma, who's at the Salk Institute in California, is doing a lot of fascinating work. For people who time restrict their eating over, say, a 10 to 12 hour period, earlier in the day, earlier in the evening, nothing within 3 hours of bedtime.
You bet.
And finding significant improvements in sleep patterns. You know, we've evolved to eat our meals at an earlier time of the day. When you look at lighting, artificial lighting, the amount of blue light, those are major triggers for alterations in circadian rhythms and sleep patterns. So I do think it's important if CPAP is not bringing you to a place of at least 6+ hours of sleep a night to connect with someone who might think about this in a bit more of an integrative way and look for some other strategies that could help restore more sleep.
You know, Mark, you make a very interesting point because when Roselle and I went to Spain early in our lives, I remember I had to eat at 6 o'clock at night. And we walk into the restaurants and they would laugh at us. And there would still be chairs up on the table. So it leads you to wonder whether some societies which eat later have worse health records.
Well, I think, at least from the current research, which is still evolving, Alan, it's the window within which people eat. The shorter that window, what we would call time-restricted feeding, mm-hmm. And the magic number would be about 10 hours, is the biggest predictor of sleep quality. So people who eat later in the day are probably starting later in the day. The main thing is not continuing mealtime over a 15+ hour period, which so many Americans do. So I think there are a lot of strategies to improve sleep, even if a person is tolerant of sleep debt, as the caller appears to be.
So now we're going to go to Suzanne. Okay, we're going to go to Suzanne, and we know we're moving along very quickly. So The faster we can go, the better. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Hi, thank you. My question is a complicated one that I'm going to do my best to make succinct. I am almost 60. I'm married. One of my lovely three children is struggling with a desperate emotional problem and has tried to take her life. It has been a very upsetting time for our whole family, but it has hit me particularly hard. So my question is this. When you have a young adult who is struggling through something, how can the parent, because this is no longer a little kid anymore, how can the parent find either a therapist or support quickly to deal with sort of separating oneself and not feeling just absolutely shocked and broken all the time from the young adult who's having a struggle?
Okay, great question, Mark.
Yeah, so Suzanne, sorry. I mean, I can feel your angst just in the way that you frame that. Clearly, if a loved one is confronting suicidal thoughts, really in a free fall emotionally, finding this usually would go through the behavioral health unit of a hospital, a good psychiatrist and a good cognitive therapist. These are usually psychologists, PhDs.
Right. So my young adult is not sticking with that. So the question, I guess, would be, how do you then, as the parent of a young adult, because you can't force them to go, you can't force them to do the wiser thing, how do you find support with such a... It's like watching, in slow motion, a train go towards your once child.
All right, Mark.
Yeah, I mean,
how does one carry on with support?
Yeah, I mean, the only two thoughts I could offer you off the top, Suzanne, would be that there are people who are of sufficient risk of harming themselves, for example, that treatment can be mandated. That is called a section. I'm most familiar with New York, with Massachusetts legislation. That's called a Section 12, where a family member can, through the court, based on one's risk, mandated treatment.
Very hard.
The only other thing I can say is that if there were anyone in your daughter's life that she might look to with a particular feeling of trust. Not to suggest that she doesn't have that with you. You obviously love her and care a great deal about her. But if there's anyone who could possibly transform her perception, someone that's very personal and very connected with her, that can perhaps relate to her, someone who's been through what she's been through, someone who has shared what she's experienced, someone who could speak with a sense of, I know what it's like to be in your shoes and to be in your skin, and this is what helped me, that would be very, very helpful.
Thank you, Suzanne. And now on to Jeff in New Jersey. Okay, it's Jeff in New Jersey. You're on.
Yes, thank you. I have a friend who is transgender, and prior to the operation, he was a little overweight and was on blood pressure medicine. And now that he is post the operation, I believe he's on immune inhibitors. With all the controversy going on today, are there health problems with someone like that? Are there possibility of health problems?
Well, there certainly are. This is a little bit outside my scope of expertise, Jeff, but anytime you're dealing with sort of profound biologic, hormonal changes that affect the phenotype, how a person appears and what their health manifestations are, there are potential issues there, including hypertension, including weight gain, what we call metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, changes in blood lipids, blood fats. So it's really important to, in addition to working with someone who's sort of literate, because not all people are literate in these areas, but it can also be helpful working with someone who does integrative sort of lifestyle medicine to help a person move beyond just some of the pharmacologic approaches that are probably at play here.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Okay, we're going to go to
Bill in Saratoga. All right, Bill, your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, doctor. I just want to ask you, do you have any knowledge or experience of doctors using medical marijuana for pain relief and as a substitute for opioids? Like, if people are hooked on opioids, they change to medical marijuana, and how is that working?
Yeah, so I think while we still have a lot to learn here, Bill, and there's a lot more research that needs to be done, where there's clearly some efficacy of medical marijuana, it's in the management of chronic pain. And in particular, I think it can help with sleep cycling in people with chronic pain. There's some early evidence, and again, we need to learn a lot more, that for those taking medical marijuana in the context of pain, that often their opiate needs do go down. That would indeed be obviously a very, very positive thing. So I'm hopeful. I think cannabis is an interesting plant with a lot of interesting biologic effects that we need to learn a lot more about. I'm glad that the tide is turning, because hopefully it will lead to better research and better indications for people. I think it can help a lot of people.
Okay, we are about out of time. We're going to have to apologize to Nicole, Kathy, and Tom, and Joan, because we don't have time for the wonderful Mark Pettis to answer your questions. Nevertheless, we did get a letter early in the program about gastric acid secretion. We only have a second or two for this. We know that in the beginning, those were told, gastroenterologists, and said, use it for a while and get off it. Most of us who have been on them for basically life. Is that dangerous?
I think it can be problematic, Alan. We have a lot more to learn about long-term use of these proton pump inhibitors. They're very good at blocking acid. Acid was not intended to be blocked forever, so people can develop issues in their gut. They may not digest food as well if they're not secreting acid. They may be at risk for what we call small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, this ecosystem of organisms which probably connect to health in many ways, migrate up to the small intestine, because acid, which is usually an inhibitor of bacterial migration, is no longer present. Mm-hmm. And then we know for some people there can be micronutrient absorption issues like B12 in particular, magnesium in particular, that people on long-term proton pump inhibitor use are at risk for. So those are things that I would be mindful of.
Mark Pettis, thank you so much. We're about out of time. My apologies to the people I mentioned who are left on the line. Again, Mark, thank you so much for coming all the way over here and being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Louvoulos. And today, Ray Graff. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.